My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at Western, I coordinate this series with my faithful colleague, Peggy Wright, back here in the gray. With us tonight is our website guru, Hai Wong Wan, who will be taking pictures, doing podcasts. Our technician tonight is Library Technology Coordinator, David Runner. Brian Carson, the reference coordinator, is here. 2009 marks the 200th anniversary of the birth in Kentucky of our most beloved president, Abraham Lincoln. And to commemorate that event, the U.S. Mint has announced that it will introduce four rotating designs on the 1 cent coin for that year, depicting aspects of his life. And the first will show a depiction of a log cabin where he was born, while the second shows Lincoln as a young man reading a book, perhaps a law book. While many studies of Lincoln have focused on Lincoln as president, few have focused on his earlier career as lawyer, which is the theme of tonight's talk. Our speaker tonight received his master's degree at Rice University and a PhD in history at the University of Kansas. He joined the Department of History and Political Science at Anderson University in Anderson, Indiana, shortly thereafter. And while his specialty is the history of the Civil War, he teaches a very popular class in baseball history at Anderson University. In his first book, Lincoln and Davis, Imagining America, 1809 to 1865, published by the University of Kansas Press, he explored each leader's ideas concerning national identity. His newest book, I see it on display here, Lincoln the Lawyer, was published in May of this year by the University of Illinois Press and focuses on the law career of the 16th president. His A Lincoln blog is one of the most popular sources for information on the latest books on Abraham Lincoln. And when not teaching or researching, Professor Dirk is an avid runner, prepares frequently to run marathons. He maintains a very popular blog, Brian's Fitness Blog, and he's a practitioner of the Japanese art of kendo. He's married with five children and leads a very active life. Please welcome Professor Brian Dirk.
Okay, glad to be here. Haven't been to Bowling Green for a couple of years now. Last time I was here, I really enjoyed myself, so it's nice to come back in town. I was listening to Brian's introduction talking about birthplace of your most beloved president, and I was thinking, did he mean Davis or Lincoln, since they were both born, fairly close by here. I suppose it depends on your loyalties and your perspective on this sort of thing. I don't know. I'm from Missouri myself, so we were similarly quite confused, or maybe complex in our loyalties as well here, okay? So I'll tell you what, what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to talk briefly about what we know about Lincoln's practice, and what I'd like to do is sort of take you into sort of the day-to-day operations of his law practice and what his life looked like as a lawyer. And then I'd like to say a few things about why I think this matters. You know, there's, good grief, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a book on Lincoln these days, and there's like a book on everything. There's even a full-length book on his career as a land surveyor, which lasted all of about 8 months when he was about 19 years old, you know, and somebody got a whole book out of that, you know. So, you know, people write about everything on Lincoln. So I'd like to suggest, after I discuss his practice, why I think this particular facet of his career not only is interesting, but had ramifications for the sort of man that he became. Okay, let's start with this photograph right here. One of my favorite pictures of him, actually. There are over 50 photographic likenesses of Abraham Lincoln. This one's rather interesting, I think. I bet you didn't know Lincoln was a good humor man on the side. You know, the white suit thing will throw you, you know. So you don't normally see this kind of picture of Abraham Lincoln. This is a picture that we have very specific documentation for. This was taken on the morning of May the 7th, 1858, in Beardstown, Illinois. Lincoln was in town for a court case. That was the county seat of that county in the 8th Judicial Circuit. He got up, stayed at a hotel there, probably had breakfast, then on his way over to the courthouse, had this photograph taken. And I always like to imagine him having it taken just so he could prove he actually wore this thing. You know, go back and say, see, Mary, see, I wore it. See, I can prove I wore the thing, right? You know. So he's on his way. This is the closest image we have of him as an attorney. Now, that particular morning was an interesting part of his legal life, because he was going to do something that he normally did not do and was very rare for him. He was going to become involved in a murder trial. Now, the circumstances of this trial were actually quite interesting. If you can flip that there to the next slide. Eventually. There we go. Okay. This is William Duff Armstrong. Later in life, at the time of the court case in question, he was actually a young man in his 20s. This is long after the only picture we have of him now. William Duff, to his friends, had in his younger days a bit of a rowdy streak. He lived near Beardstown, Illinois, and some evening, a few months before the court case, he was with a couple of friends, a young man of similar age named John Metzger, and another friend named John Norris. And they were attending a church revival camp meeting on the outskirts of Beardstown. And the way this thing was set up, they had the camp meeting, and then on the perimeter of the camp meeting, they had a series of makeshift saloons. I guess if you didn't get the Holy Spirit there, you could get other spirits on the outer edge there, okay? So, and he was not there for Jesus. I can assure you, he went with his friends to go get riotously drunk, and he did. He sort of made the circle. Basically, these were just like picnic tables with a lot of booze. You know, they'd go from one to the other, and keep going. And apparently, he and his two friends were getting more and more inebriated as they went along, and eventually got into a loud argument, the substance of which we really don't know what exactly got them upset. Hey, they're drunk, you know, there you go. And according to eyewitnesses, he and Norris turned and assaulted Metzger, savagely beating him. Norris apparently hit Metzger several times, quite violently, until he, according to eyewitnesses, whipped out a weapon, a homemade device called a slung shot, which was a chunk of lead wrapped in a canvas bag and then hooked to a string that you could sling like a sling. Yeah, real nasty stuff here. And he pulled this out, and he swung it, and he hit Metzger square in the face, doing considerable damage. Metzger didn't die right away, though. He fell to the ground, probably sustained multiple injuries to his head, got up, though, got on his horse, fell off his horse a couple of times on the way home, where he sort of landed on his front porch as he rode up. His wife hauled him in, and Metzger died 2 days later. Now, the local authorities very quickly arrested Duff and Norris, and the two men were tried separately. Norris's trial was first. Norris received 8 years at hard labor, and everybody pretty much figured he was going to get the same or worse, since he was the one that whipped out the weapon. Okay, and that was going to make things much worse. Now, what's Lincoln got to do with this? Well, Lincoln lives in Springfield, Illinois, knows nothing about all of this, until he receives a letter from a woman named Hannah Armstrong, which is Duff's mother. This is Hannah, again, actually about the time of the case, maybe a little bit later. Hannah Armstrong was a close friend of Abraham Lincoln's. She had known him when he was just a rough teenager growing up in New Salem, Illinois. As a matter of fact, Abraham Lincoln had stayed at her house. He later said that she later said that he bounced Duff up and down on his knee and gave him candy. She helped fix his pants when he was wandering through the brambles trying to do surveying work. So he was well disposed towards Hannah. Hannah wrote Lincoln a letter saying, and we don't know what it said, but something to the effect of, help my son, okay, I need a lawyer. She was a widower at this point, she didn't have much money. She begs Lincoln to help him. Now, we don't know the exact circumstances here, but as I surmise in my book, I think Lincoln was very reluctant to get involved in this. He had not done many murder cases, and most of the murder cases he had been involved in, he lost. So he really was not a criminal lawyer, and I think he probably wrote a letter back telling her this, but she felt so strongly that she actually boarded a stage and went directly to Springfield and showed up at his front door and played on his sympathies or something. It worked, because then she got him to agree to take the case. So Lincoln goes to Beardstown, Illinois that morning to do something that I suspect made him fairly nervous. This is not, you know, bankruptcy or a will or even a divorce. This was a man's life hanging in the balance. Now, when he got to the courthouse, Duff already had another attorney, but Lincoln sort of took over because he had a pretty good reputation around the state at that point. And the problem that Lincoln had was that they had an eyewitness, a man named Allen, who claimed he had seen Duff do the deed. and Lincoln need very badly to impeach this man's testimony. Before the trial began, Lincoln took a book and handed it to the court bailiff. And he said, "I want you to hang on to this, and if I signal for it, I want you to bring it to me so I can have it." The bailiff goes, "Well, all right, fine." So Lincoln begins the case. He gets Allen up on the stand, and he gets Allen, he asks him, he says, "How could you see this? This is the middle of the night. How could you possibly see that it was this guy that did this?" And Allen stated not once but several times, "Well, there was a full moon out. It lit everything up bright as day. I clearly saw Duff whack the guy with the slingshot." And once Lincoln got him to say that under oath, he signals for the book. Bailiff slowly carries the book across the courtroom. Lincoln holds it up and says, "This is an almanac for this time of the year, and according to this almanac, there was no moon that night, so you couldn't possibly have seen what you say you saw, thereby impeaching the man's testimony, casting into doubt the case pretty well." And then when the time came to summarize before the jury, we do not have a copy of his jury speech, unfortunately. We have some eyewitnesses who later said that he basically played on the jury's heartstrings. He said, and really, from what I understand, he really put on quite a show, basically saying, "I knew this poor woman, you know, she's a wonderful lady, she's a poor widower, don't send her poor Duff to the gallows," and all that. And between the almanac and that, he manages to get Duff an acquittal. So Duff is let off on the murder. After all, and later on, he does not charge Hannah any money. And then during the Civil War, when Duff is called up for the draft, Hannah again contacts then-President Lincoln and asks that her son be let off, and he does so, and Duff lived well after the Civil War. Now, this is the most famous court case of Lincoln's career. You see it in, if a book deals with his law practice at all, I guarantee you it will deal with this. For example, this is Henry Fonda in the film Young Mr. Lincoln. Has anybody seen that? It's a very old film. You know, I like it. It's in a kind of corny kind of way. You know, I'd say it's a good film. This is Henry arguing the film's version of the almanac case, which they played around with the facts, starting with the fact that he ain't dressed right. Okay, kind of going from there. Okay, and then also we have this painting done by Norman Rockwell called Mr. Lincoln for the Defense. It's on the front cover of my book. As you can see, Mr. Rockwell did do his homework. He is wearing the white suit. Although Rockwell apparently felt compelled to kind of muddy him up a little bit with his straps down and the tie askew and all that. And you can see poor Duff praying for his life here in the background. You get the idea, right? This is quite dramatic. You know, this is Abe as Perry Mason, you know, in many ways. And the question that you ask is, Was that his life? You know, was he like one big Law and Order episode over all this time, or was it different from that? Well, the trouble is, guys, if you pick up a book about Lincoln written really anywhere up until, say, just a couple of years ago, the authors, if they know what they're doing and they're honest, will say, "We have no idea." Because there really wasn't much in the way of documentation on Abraham Lincoln's law practice prior to that point. We had a scattering of papers, a few cases here and there, nothing else. But then, in 2000, a project called the Lincoln Legal Papers Project, funded by the state of Illinois. Illinois loves Abe, and they will spend money on things. They really will. And this was quite the expensive project. They went through every courthouse in the old 8th Judicial Circuit, which is most of the middle of Illinois. I mean, this was quite the undertaking. It took them a decade to go through every courthouse basement, every dusty docket book, every backwoods little storage area, and they culled out every single document they could find related to Abraham Lincoln's law practice. At the end of the day, they unearthed over 90,000 new documents that had never been seen before, and they gave us documentation for something in the neighborhood of 5,000 new cases for Abraham Lincoln's law practice. And that was the backbone of my particular project. Now, What have we learned then about Abraham Lincoln as a lawyer? Well, let me just tell you the basic facts here. I'll kind of give you an idea of what things looked like for him, and then we'll go a little further into some other issues, okay? This is the earliest known photograph of Lincoln, taken quite a few years before the white suit, Abe. All right? This is the earliest, you know, faithfully documented image. And this is probably kind of what he looked like as an attorney. It's not quite the Lincoln you expect, is it? His hair is slicked down. He doesn't look like a rube at all. In fact, when this photograph was discovered in the 1950s, some people doubted its authenticity. He just didn't look hillbilly enough, you know? But this gives you, I think, a good image for it, okay? He lived the life that legend has given us as a young backwoods farm boy. Here first in Kentucky, just down the road, as you all know, and then later they relocated across the Ohio River into Indiana, where he grew into early adolescence, then later in Illinois. He had almost no formal education. That part of the Lincoln myth is quite true. He has to basically educate himself. He tries a number of different jobs, everything from surveying to being a clerk at a general store to postmaster, you name it. He was a jack of all trades. But the truth is, guys, he's a very ambitious man. This is one of the facets of Lincoln that people tend to ignore. His law partner, Billy Herndon, later said his ambition was a little engine that knew no rest. And you're not going to get anywhere as a postal clerk. You know, so he chooses to be an attorney. Now, back then, there were almost no law schools in the United States. If you wanted to be a lawyer, you had to know a lawyer who had the books that you needed. That was the main thing. You needed to get a hold of a book written by a man named Sir William Blackstone called Commentaries on the English Law. Now, it's English, but it's so close to our system that it's pretty good. And some other texts as well. He met a man named John Stuart during the Black Hawk War when he served in the Illinois militia. They became friends. Stuart was a lawyer, and he loaned Lincoln the books that he needed. And Lincoln, as with everything else with the guy, was basically self-taught. We have eyewitness accounts of him sitting on logs, plowing fields, reading the law book as he went. One of his friends walked by him one day, saw Lincoln curled up with a book, and said, "Abe, what you reading?" And Lincoln said, "The law." And the guy looked at him, barefoot, hairy legs sticking out from under his trousers, hair unkempt, and he said, "The law? You? Good God Almighty!" And just kept walking. All right. So this wasn't exactly a neat fit, but he does read the law. He takes his exam, and when I say exam, guys, that's really generous. Okay, basically, when he felt like he was ready, they found the local judge. The judge would ask a few questions. It really depended on whether the judge was well-disposed towards you as to whether you're going to pass the darn thing, all right? And apparently he did okay, and he was entered in 1836 into the lists of attorneys as a member of the Illinois Bar. Now, this is John Stuart, John Todd Stuart. If you recognize the middle name, this is Mary's cousin, okay? This is his first law partner, and also the man who loaned him his first law books. When Lincoln partnered with Stuart, Stuart was very much the senior partner. Stuart was also much, much more interested in politics than he was in the law. He wanted to be a congressman, and in fact, he went to Congress right after Lincoln started. Now, put yourself in Lincoln's shoes. This guy's never been a lawyer before. He hardly knows what he's doing, and the minute he gets this partnership, John there heads off to D.C. and leaves Lincoln holding the bag. Many of you may have read that Lincoln suffered bouts of depression. And we all have been taught that he was depressed over things with Mary. Well, yeah, I'm sure it's true. But it's also the case that he was left in a very bad way by Mr. Stuart here. And his depression actually coincides with this as well. That he didn't quite know what he was doing. If you look at his correspondence from this time, you can tell he feels out of his depth. You know, he loses paperwork and has to apologize to clients. He showed up for a court case one time representing the firm of Stuart and Lincoln. The guy took one look at Lincoln and got another lawyer. So that man is not going to represent me, all right? So there it was. So he has a rough beginning. Now, after a while, John here decides that he wants to go off into politics and folds the partnership. Lincoln's second partner is this man, Stephen Logan. Logan had been a judge in Illinois, but decided he could make more money as a lawyer, believe it or not. shot, so he goes back to the law. Logan was an interesting sort. They say they cleaned him up for the engravings. They said he was actually much more uglier than this will show you. And he was. They said that when he was hearing cases, he'd have a gunny sack and a knife and a sapling, and he'd whittle during all the court cases, all right, and drive the lawyers nuts. They said he was actually very mean to attorneys, but he and Lincoln got along really well. And they became lawyers or partners again. Logan here is the senior partner. Lincoln is the junior. But we credit Logan, I think, with making Lincoln into a more systematic attorney. He kind of takes Lincoln under his wing, cleans up his paperwork, cleans Lincoln up a little bit, I imagine, at this point, and teaches him a lot about this. Now, after a few years, Logan decides that he wants to partner with his son instead, and he and Lincoln part on amiable terms. It's not a bad breakup at all, at which point Lincoln goes looking for his third and last partner. This would be Billy Herndon. You gotta love Billy. This guy is quite the interesting character. At this point, guys, Abe Lincoln had been a lawyer for over eight years at this point, so he's done a lot. Billy is just getting his law license, therefore now Lincoln's going to be the senior partner. And that's the way it remained, and this would be his third and last partner all the way up to the time that Lincoln goes to Washington, D.C. Billy Herndon had a very highly developed gift for technical research. They worked very well together because Lincoln was a good speech maker. He'd go in front of a jury and persuade you to stuff. He knew how to go find precedents in the case books. He knew how to do research. He was also one of these people that sometimes doesn't seem to have their brain and their mouth wired quite together, you know? He had a tendency to offend people because he'd express an opinion on just about everything. He had kind of a loose cannon quality about him. He's also an alcoholic. Lincoln has to bail him out on more than one occasion after a drinking spree. Later on, after Lincoln dies, Billy Herndon will become the first really great Lincoln biographer when he writes a book called Herndon's Lincoln, which is now one of the best primary sources that we have on Abraham Lincoln and his life. And also, by the way, Billy really hated Mary Lincoln. We won't go there. It's a long story. Okay. Anyway, these are his partners. This is a modern photograph of the law office. He had several law offices. If you go to Springfield, you can see this. This is the modern display. It's pretty accurate. It's located in the Tinsley Building. You can't see, but right through those windows is the State Capitol Building with the federal courts. And this is also located right above the Federal Circuit Court, so it's a very well-located office. What we have from eyewitness accounts bears this out, that they have the tables in a green T-shape with the bays over it and stuff scattered. I think it's too clean, personally, okay? Because from everything I've read, Lincoln and Billy were epic slobs. I mean, lawyers are supposed to be slobs back then. They're sort of this manly thing. Real men don't dust, all right? You know, and lawyers are kind of like that. But even other lawyers who went into this place kind of went, ugh, you know, that sort of thing. They said that the windows, you couldn't see out of them because they were so dirty, and you wouldn't open them because there was a stable located right underneath the windowsill, and the smell would cause you to shut them very, very quickly. They said the dirt was all over the place. One law student who read for the law here one time noticed that in one corner of the room there was a bag of bean sprouts that had been sitting there for so long that the bag broke open and the seeds spilled out, and there was so much dirt on the floor that bean plants were growing out of the corner of the room. The paperwork was a disaster. Lincoln had a huge pile of papers in the middle of that table, bound with a string, and a note on it that says, if you can't find it anywhere else, look in here. That's how organized he was. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons he wore a stovepipe hat, great place to stuff the paperwork. All right? He'd walk out the door in the morning with the hat on his head. Kids in the neighborhood liked to play pranks on him by tying a string over the sidewalk where they knew he would go to wipe out his hat and send his paperwork scurrying down the sidewalk. Yeah, we're talking kind of mom-and-pop operation here, guys, all right? We're not talking Johnny Cochran or any kind of highfalutin legal thing, okay? You wonder how this whole thing worked in many ways, all right? Now, Lincoln actually spent as little time in here as he could. He hated hated his office, I think, you know. He didn't like being confined. Moreover, it just wasn't good business. And back then, you just would not have enough business to earn a living if you just sat in this room, all right? Even though it's a very well-located office. What you had to do was called ride the circuit. And this was how he earned a big chunk of his living. We have to kind of estimate here, but it depends on which year you're talking about. But we think he earned as much as 35% to 40% of his retainers on the circuit. Now, the way this worked was this. There wasn't enough money in Illinois to put a judge in every town. Okay, they weren't going to pay for that, all right? What they would do is get one judge who usually two, sometimes three times a year, would saddle up his buggy, all right, hop in, and with a dozen or so lawyers like Lincoln in train, they would go from county seat to county seat. And everybody in that particular county would know when the judge was going to be there. They would show up, they'd open up the courthouse, and then Lincoln and the other attorneys would sort of be there if you needed to go sue your neighbor or some problem had to be solved. And you rode from town to town to town to town doing that kind of thing. This is seat of your pants law. Lincoln couldn't bring much with him. He packed his copy of Blackstone, a book called Chitty's Pleadings, which gave you the forms for all the pleadings and the writs that you had to know, and his wits. And that's about all he had to work with. Most lawyers didn't go out on the circuit any more than they had to. The roads were horrible, the food was bad, the accommodations were worse. It was not a pleasant place to be. Lincoln loved every single minute of it. That he was the only lawyer of that whole group that stayed out every day he could out on the circuit. There were those who thought that he did it to avoid Mary because they were having fights. I don't buy that, okay? I really don't see the evidence for it, okay? I think he just liked traveling. I think he just enjoyed being out and about that way. And he really liked the company of the men that he was with. And these men later became some of his closest friends. A guy named Ward Hill Lamon, Henry C. Whitney, and the most important man, a man named David Davis, a judge who weighed 300 pounds, had to have four horses carry his buggy around because he was so fat, and was a very good friend of Lincoln's. In fact, one little account I've got in my book is one of the lawyers goes up to a hotel room one night, opens the door, and Lincoln and Davis are in a pillow fight. And Lincoln's smacking Davis on the head with the pillow, laughing so hard he can't stop, feathers everywhere. And they said, poor Davis, who's 300 pounds, is huffing and puffing and leaning against the bed, telling him to stop, you know, all that. Davis would later be Abraham Lincoln's campaign manager and was probably responsible more than any other single person for getting him the 1860 nomination. So he makes important connections. This was Raymond Massey riding the circuit in another film about Lincoln. I'll just kind of throw that in there. Okay, now, what kind of law practice did he have? What sort of cases did he do? What sort of cases didn't he do? I mean, you'd have a hard time narrowing that one down. Once we went through, or I went through, all the cases, and I think the eye twitch is gone now, you know, I think I read them all here just about. He did every conceivable form of litigation you can imagine. Lawyers back then usually did not specialize. It just didn't pay. On occasion, you find a lawyer who did, but guys like him had to take what came at them. He litigated every form of legal dispute you can imagine. Larceny, bankruptcy, probate, divorce cases, partnership dissolutions. He had railroad litigation for big railroads later on in his life. He also had clients trying to sue those very same railroads later on in life. There really isn't any specialty here except this. Over half of the cases that we have involved some form of debt collection. Insofar as Lincoln had a specialty, he was a debt collection attorney. Cash is very scarce on the Illinois frontier. If you want to go start a business, if you want to go do anything, you're probably going to fund it with a promissory note, an IOU. I'm going to owe you $500. And then, of course, these things would sometimes crash. They do not have credit agencies back then. They don't have freecreditreport.com and all that stuff out there yet. There is no credit apparatus to oil the machinery of credit and debt. If the guy's not going to pay you, you go get him. And what I've discovered is that more often than not, he represented the man trying to collect the debt, not the man trying to keep from paying the debt. Now, there are some who would say, well, that must mean he liked creditors better than debtors. It wouldn't go quite that far, okay? I think Lincoln probably just took the cases that came his way. A creditor was more likely to walk into his office than a debtor for the simple fact that a lot of these debtors would skip town, you know, and you could get away with that back then. As a matter of fact, if you went up to a farm in Illinois or elsewhere and you tried to foreclose on the farm, you saw the words GTT carved on the door, that meant gone to Texas, and you ain't ever getting your money back. It's a much different world back then. So he represents the creditor more often than the debtor, not, I think, because of any sympathies here, but simply because that was the business that came to him. And that is really the main thing that I learned looking at Lincoln's practice. Because, see, here's the problem, guys. Well, it's a problem, but it is really what it is. He became really famous, okay? And then he went and got himself shot. And then after that happened, he became a martyr, you know? And when that happened, all of these old lawyers and all of these old judges were publishing their books in the 1870s and the 1880s, saying, I knew Abe back in the day, and wow, what a fine lawyer. Finest attorney I ever met. Never lost a case. Never represent a guilty client. That's my favorite one right there, okay? One story had it that he was in the middle of a trial, suddenly discovered that his client was guilty, and he was with another lawyer named Leonard Sweat, and according to the myth, he turns to Sweat and says, oh God, Sweat, I can't defend this man. You do it, and gave up. All right? Yeah, right. And Santa Claus reads every letter. I can't see it, all right? There's another case in which he was supposed to have stood up in a courtroom and said, Judge, I've just found some cases that support my opponent. I'm going to give this to you and just let you figure out what you're going to do. He would have really lost business over something like that. It just didn't happen, guys. I mean, a lot of what we think we know about him comes as hyperbole from after-the-fact people wanting to say, I touched the hem of greatness. I knew Abe, and a lot of these guys would say later on, I knew he was going to be president, you know? Everybody knew that he was the greatest thing going in the Illinois bar. He was compared favorably to John Marshall. He was called the greatest lawyer in the United States. He was called the greatest moral force in the Illinois bar. There were people who claimed that you could find parables for good and evil in every case he litigated. Well, no, not really, you know. I mean, what people did was they picked and chose the pieces they liked and the pieces they found interesting. A lot of the stuff isn't very interesting. Trust me on this, okay? A lot of these are just boring cases. Debt collection ain't real sexy, okay? You don't get to wave an almanac. You don't get to save the widow's son most of the time. Ida Tarbell, one of Lincoln's early biographers, flatly stated, most of Lincoln's cases are utterly uninteresting. And that's true. That's entirely true. But it's his life. You know, I mean, if you're going to understand the guy, you've got to take a frank look at him. You know, we mythologize Abraham Lincoln more than I think any other American figure, maybe even more than George Washington. And I don't think that has led up much at all in the last few years. I really don't. And I'm not necessarily criticizing this. I admire the guy too. But let's be frank here. He was not a great attorney. He was a good attorney, all right? But he didn't do anything in his law practice that was extraordinary. The vast majority of his litigation is in the circuit level of the state of Illinois. On occasion, he would end up in the Illinois Supreme Court for the appellate level, and on very rare occasions, he would end up in the federal system. Most of his stuff is down on what you might call the nickel and dime level of being a lawyer. He earned a comfortable living. He was a middling class attorney. He could buy a nice home for his family. He could earn a good living. And by the time he gets around to about, I don't know, 1850 or so, he's in good good enough shape that he doesn't really have to worry about, you know, lawsuits over $2 hogs and that kind of thing, although he still has small cases packed with the big ones all the way to the end. He probably won more cases than he lost, but then it's hard to say, right? I mean, for example, if he has a case where he's asking for $10,000 damages and the jury only awards $800, is that a win or a loss? Hard to say. Maybe he was purposely asking for a much higher amount than he thought he could get to get a good bargaining position. Maybe his client thought he deserved 10 grand and got real mad at him. Maybe his client thought he didn't even deserve the 800 and was grateful for whatever this guy could get. You know? So, this isn't Perry Mason. You can't really draw a dark line between win and lose. He had a lot of repeat business. A lot of people came back to him time and again for litigation, which suggests to me that generally speaking, he was good at what he did. Otherwise, he probably wouldn't have got people coming back 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 times. He was perfectly willing to represent guilty clients. Not because he liked doing that, but because he is a professional attorney. He is taught by the mores of his time that he takes the case and does the best he can within the bounds of legal propriety for his client. Now, he never did anything unethical that we know of or anything beyond the pale of what the profession in his day said was ethical and right. And I base that on the fact that if you look at the literature in his political career, the guy was accused of being everything from a thief to an adulterer, but nobody ever accused him of being a shyster lawyer. You know? So he was ethical within the professional bounds. He did not cherry-pick his clients for their moral worth. You look at these early biographies, a lot of them say that he would size somebody up and see if they were a good person, then he'd take their case. I don't see it. If you look at all the cases, he represents every sort of person. Also, you don't really see much in his law practice that would suggest echoes of the great emancipator. There are very few cases involving African Americans in his law practice. I forget the exact number, guys, it's flown out of my head, but out of the 5,000 cases, if I remember correctly, I think it's about 30. I mean, that's a really small percentage, all right? And I mean, a lot depends on what you think of Lincoln. He did, in one case, defend the rights of a slaveholder trying to recover property in slaves. And he has been blasted by people who call him a racist for taking this case. It's called the Matson case. On the other hand, he also had several cases in which he defended the rights of men harboring runaway slaves, probably on the Underground Railroad or something along those lines. He also did pro bono legal work for an African-American barber in Springfield named Billy Florville, known as Billy the Barber. So it's hard to make a decision here about whether you see good Lincoln, bad Lincoln here. I think he simply picked the cases that came his way. You know? Now, why bother with this? Why does it really matter? Granted, his role as the savior of the Union and his role as the author of The Great Emancipator far outshines anything he did on the Illinois circuit. But I would argue that there are things you can learn about Abraham Lincoln here. Because Lincoln learned things on the circuit system and in the courtrooms that he would not have learned elsewhere. I mean, think about it. Most of the people this man knew came out of his law practice. And he knew everybody. You could make a pretty good case that it was what we would now call it was the networking that he did as a lawyer, meeting all of these people, that probably launched his political career. And as I pointed out, many of his buddies in the bench and bar were instrumental in building his case for the presidency. But moreover, and I make this argument in the last chapter of my book, I think what Lincoln learned was how people interact in a community and how they resolve disputes. Because think about what he would have seen as a lawyer. He saw it all, man. 25 years, a quarter century at the Illinois Bar, 5,000 2,000 cases. He saw just about every conceivable form of human depravity that you could probably come up with. You know, I do a chapter in my book on his divorce cases and some of the really sad stories he ran into. And on his criminal practice, which was quite small, but he saw all forms of violence. He saw forms of death and destruction. He saw people mad at each other. He put himself in the center of people going at each other all the time. And I think what he learned from that is the art of compromise, the ability to negotiate, and most of all, he learned not to assume that he knew the inner motives and feelings of the people around him. I mean, think about what the law would have taught him. It would have taught him that you don't really know what the motives are of the people in this case. You don't really know whether the witnesses are lying. You can make a guess, you can make an argument, but you never really know. And we see this in his presidency. Lincoln was famous during the war for not taking things personally, for not taking slights and insults to heart. The man had to deal with George McClellan, after all. My God, that alone would take a lot of Herculean patience. And what I argue is that he learned this patience at the bar. He learned that you don't personalize things, because when you do, that's when conflicts get out of hand. He learned to keep a distance from the people around him. He learned to negotiate, and he learned that things aren't always what they seem, so what you pay attention to are the procedures. And I think that this was a useful skill for Mr. Lincoln. Moreover, he learned the art of presentation. You know, can I go back to the white suit picture real quick? It's at the very beginning, if we can do that. Let's go back to the white suit here. Why wear a white suit? Think about it. He's defending a man on trial for his life with a jury box filled with people that are quite likely going to convict him. White symbols purity, innocence, that kind of thing. Sounds corny to us today, but it might give him a little bit of an edge, all right, in that jury box. And what I've discovered looking at his cases is that he knew how to pitch an image. And I do not mean that cynically. I kind of admire it, frankly. All right? He learned how to seem so that he could get what he needed. For example, I've seen eyewitness accounts of Abraham Lincoln from people in the courtroom, and they said, God, what a slob. How can they let this man in the room? He's got mud in his boots, his tie's half off, he talks like a hillbilly, his hair's not combed, he looks like a rough farmer. And then I'd go look at the case in the room at the time, and guess what? The litigants were farmers. The jury box was full of farmers. And then I'd see another account in which they'd say, you know, I heard Lincoln was a real slob, but he looks pretty good. You know, his tie's straight, he's got a cravat, his boots are polished and all that. Then you look at the case, and the litigants are middle to upper class people, and the jury box is filled with respectable citizens. He learned how to pitch an image. And I would argue that white suit is a subtle way to get an edge. And again, I'm not being cynical about this. I think this is an essential trait that any successful president must have. Knowing how to portray the particular image you need to get people to do what you need them to do. And I think that's the most important lesson that Lincoln learned at the bar. And then most of all, I think, looking at his law practice humanizes Abraham Lincoln. Because there's nothing glamorous here, but that's the point. Okay? This is the man who got up every day and went to work and came home. It's a part of him that I think we need to remember. We sometimes put him in far too lofty heights. We sometimes make him into something superhuman. You want to humanize Lincoln? Look at what he did to earn a dollar every day, day in and day out. It's not romantic. It's kind of grubby in a way. But it is a side of him that if we lose track of it, we lose track of the man. We lose track of the human being who had to do all this stuff to earn a living. Well, that's it. I'll take questions now, if you like.
I have two.
Okay, fire away.
First, did they do contingency clauses back then?
Did everybody hear the question? Do they do contingency fees? I've run across a few, very few. I mean, you know, so much so that I'm not even sure. I didn't even mention it in the book because I'm not sure what the circumstances are. See, one of the problems we've got with this is, yeah, we got 5,000 new cases, but there's very little information sometimes. And if I remember from the contingency fees, it just says that there was one. We don't know the amount. We don't know the circumstances. And in some cases, it may not even have been Lincoln, because sometimes it was listed as Lincoln and Herndon. And it may be Billy taking contingency fees rather than Abe, and they didn't separate them out. So yeah, it did sometimes happen. But there's not enough to draw conclusions, in other words. It's too small a sample size. So yeah.
It just seems like if he's going to collect a lot of debts, that's the best way to do it.
But yeah, I don't know. It's the funny thing about the way he collects these debts, the clients are usually fairly, I wouldn't say well-to-do, but people with some cash. You know, I have a chapter called The Energy Men, and I talk about how these guys that he works with are entrepreneurs, you know, that have just a cash flow issue, you know. And, you know, contingency fees, yeah, you might think so, but I think he also knew a lot of these guys, you know, and I think he was more trusting that way, you know, so there's that, you know.
And second, what's the weirdest case that he took?
Oh, he had some slander cases that were a trip. You know, you think your great-great-grandparents didn't know words, man. They did. Oh, Lordy, you know, they're fun. The weirdest case I saw was a slander case involving this woman named, I forget, it was Emily Fancher, I think was her name. And Emily was a school teacher, and one of the men in the town had accused her of doctoring the books and adding more pupils than she really had to get more money from the state. And then he had also remarked to somebody that her father should take her back to the bad house where he found her, and maybe the sores on her neck would then disappear.
Whoa.
What the heck does that mean? That sounds like a reference to some kind of social disease, I suppose. She took that quite personally and sued him for slander. Now, the funny thing about this, I guess it's kind of funny. So Lincoln is her attorney, okay, trying to get damages for damaging her reputation. And at the end of the day, the jury, because truth is a defense in this, guys. If you can prove it's true, then it's not slander, okay? The jury found for Lincoln's client that she had been slandered where the doctoring of the books was concerned, but not where the sores in her neck were concerned. So basically, she was a fraud. She was a whore, I guess, is the way you kind of come down that. I read that case and went, that would have been a really interesting one. I wish I knew more about that, you know? So there's that. Another case I found was kind of fun was he had a guy named James Reed, who was a favorite client, who had his fingers in all these pies. I mean, this guy had investments all over the place, and he's always getting himself in trouble and getting Lincoln to bail him out by going to get, because this is one of the few times that his client was the guy who owed money, okay, and Lincoln would help him deal with it. Finally, 1846, Mr. Reed decided that business prospects just weren't so good in Illinois anymore, and that he would do better if he went out to Oregon. So he gathers up his family and hooks up with a family named the Donners. Yeah, those Donners, yeah, you know. Turns out that was his worst business decision ever right there, you know. So I discovered that Lincoln had actually represented a member of the Donner family, which was fairly, party, which was fairly cool, I thought so. Other questions, guys?
You mentioned contacts that he made during the period of his law practice that he later utilized in his campaigns. What about his thinking about politics? Did that come into play during this period?
That's a great question. I tended to draw a distinction between his political and his legal career, because what I found was his politics didn't match up with what he did in the court very well. For example, I mean, his politics were, he was a Whig who supported economic growth and development, who wanted the state to get involved in building railroads and canals and roads and all this stuff. And he's very enthusiastic about that, okay? But then when you look at his practice, he is defending, like I said, both railroads and people who sue railroads. He's defending people trying to shut down roads. He's defending people suing about canals in the right-of-way. In other words, when you look at his clients, they don't fit with what he's doing in the State House, and I think he drew a pretty good distinction between what he did there and what he did in the law in the law firm, you know. And I saw that pretty much across the board. You really can't get a logic there where you say, "Oh yeah, this looks like what he would have done as a politician." It just doesn't show up.
Is there any evidence that his early life in Kentucky inspired him in some way to enter the legal profession?
Well, that's a great question, and the problem is there's a lot of hyperbole out there. The trouble we've got, guys, the trouble we got is that almost all of the information that we have about Lincoln, other than the cases, come from after the Civil War. There are almost no extant descriptions of Lincoln during his law practice by other lawyers. Now, there are people after the fact who later said that when Lincoln was a little boy, he wandered into a Kentucky courtroom. The kid was, what, 5? Okay? And was just mesmerized by what he saw, you know? I mean, some of this stuff is so maudlin, it's ridiculous, you know? There's one account that he sat down and read the statutes of the state of Indiana from cover to cover. Yeah, right. I just don't buy that, you know. And because it was a guy in 1890 saying this, you know. Now, in Kentucky, what we do know is this. His dad, his father, Thomas, got sued a fair amount. Thomas got sued over some carpentry work that wasn't performed up to his client's standards, and he got into court over some land title issues. And I kind of speculate in the book that it's entirely possible that Lincoln probably accompanied the family to a courthouse. But he's so little. I mean, he's only like, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years old, and it's hard to say if it had a real effect, you know. Then he goes to Illinois, and there's also some stories about that he would go to hang out at the courtrooms and watch the lawyers plead. Well, everybody did that. I mean, what else are you going to do in the Illinois frontier to entertain yourself? So there's nothing really special there. I think he chose to be an attorney because he's ambitious, and it's the only real means for somebody with no education like him to pull himself up. That's what I think. Good. Other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned in the book that he, in fact, was heavily indebted for this store.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Berry store. Yeah.
Is there a connection between trying to get out of debt and getting into the law?
Well, he was paying on that debt until the Mexican War. Man, he had the thing. I mean, guys, he invested in a general store with a guy named William Berry, who turned out to be a drunkard and a blowhard, and ended up leaving Lincoln holding the bag for a lot of money. I forget how much it totaled out to be, but Lincoln had all of his goods sold at the sheriff's sale, things like that, and he was hanging on to that. There's no direct connection that I can see. He never said that. But then that doesn't... Lincoln hardly ever said anything about why he became a lawyer, so it's hard to tell. I speculate in the book that it may have given him a bit more sympathy with the debtors, because he was one himself, but we don't have much hard evidence on that. The record's silent. There's only one document out there. It's called Fragments for a Law Lecture, in which Lincoln actually sat down and thought about what it meant to be a lawyer. And we don't know what this was for. We think he may have given it as a speech someplace, and it's like advice to young lawyers. But that's the only thing we got. And he never told anybody why he became a lawyer and what was motivating him. The record's silent, and you have to kind of guess at it. Good. Other questions, guys?
Do you have other questions?
You know, I say that the rail splitter and somebody that's a lawyer.
True.
Did he, as president, distance himself from his lawyer background, or how did he sort of get his lawyer?
Yeah, yeah.
Was that an attempt? Was that a sort of...
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. You know, when he first got elected president, if you look at what people were saying about him behind his back, they were bagging on him because he was William Seward, for example, who lost out for the 1860 nomination, was very upset about this. And he said, he told some friend of his, he said, "Can you imagine my disappointment losing out to that little Illinois barrister," or something like that. And I saw him referred to in a Southern paper as a backwoods pettifogger, you know, and some stuff like that. But that kind of goes away after 1860, and I've never seen a conscious effort for him to do that. I think people stopped talking about his lawyerliness after about 60 and 61. There are too many other things to bag on, I think. You know, I think the emancipation got him enough trouble, you know. But, you know, that's a really great question. I've never actually seen anybody, like during the election of 64, saying, "Get that stinking lawyer out of the White House." I would love to look into that. I've never actually seen that, but if you dug a bit, you might find something. Yeah, yeah.
I think the Lincoln Douglas debates are famous by now.
Oh, right? Totally. Yeah.
So I guess I'm not sure about the dates. Mm-hmm. Where do you think his oratory skills originated? Is it in the courtroom, or is it somewhere before that?
I totally think it's the courtroom. If you look at his early speeches, they're not real good, okay? I mean, let's face it. I mean, he's wordy. He tends to be bombastic. If you look at when he's first running for the state legislature, he cracks corny jokes. I mean, he got elected, okay, but there's nothing special there. But then I think as he matures as an attorney, I think, and this isn't just me, there's some other scholars who look at this too, that his lawyerliness gave him the qualities that we admire in him as an orator. His direct and to-the-point way of doing things, his succinctness, the fact that he would pare things down to their essentials. You know, I think his legal training gave him that. And he got rid of all that oratory floweriness that everybody thought was very popular. I would say that probably really shows up in a lot of his speeches around the 1850s, though. I think it takes a long time. Because I think he has to learn his craft in front of a jury. But he tells Billy Herndon, he says, you know, Billy, whenever you give a speech to a jury, don't aim too high or you're going to go right over their heads. You know, aim where you think that the masses can understand. You can see him learning how to do this in front of a jury. That's mostly his audience most of the time, you know, who he's talking to.
Any time for one more question? Back here?
I was just wondering if you came across all those papers that you found, anything that was legal writings. Would they have to write pleadings or?
Oh, yeah.
So that sort of stuff, can you kind of trace the development?
It depends on the case. Most cases we have next to nothing. We have the names of the litigants, we have the type of case it is, and we have who won. And that's about it. And that's very frustrating. You know, and I was writing this book, it was very frustrating. I was thinking, what am I going to do with this? You know, I have nothing to work with. If it was a more well-known case, there was a case called the Effie Apton case. It was about a steamship that crashed into the Illinois River in the St. Louis. They had newspaper coverage. And you can get in that, and that can give you some things to work with. But the trouble is, I can count on the fingers of one hand the number of cases that we have as jury speeches, for example. I mean, there's 5,000 cases. Actually, most of these cases weren't even jury cases anyway. Most of them were just in front of a judge. But even of the few hundred or so that we know were jury cases, maybe we've got a half a dozen or so that we know what he actually said in front of the jury. So it's very difficult to do what you're asking. I wish I could. Nobody kept this stuff. You know, usually, you know, the court would throw out, you know, writs and garnishments and pleas. They'd hang on to some stuff, and maybe if you got real lucky, if it's a very popular case, you can find it someplace else, but most of the time the courts just have the docket book, and that's about it.
On behalf of WKU Libraries and our host, Barnes & Noble, Friends of Libraries, our sponsor, we want to thank you for coming out. Brian will be happy to autograph copies of his book at the end here, and hope you have a great evening.
Thank you.